Okay, welcome everybody. We are live with the coach panel for the FIH Women's World Cup. And we have three top coaches joining us from all over the world. So always happy to have different continents on these talks. Let me do a very quick introduction. Ladies first, obviously, Zoanella Polo. I hope for everybody down below here for me. Zoanella Polo is a coach from South Africa, has been an international player, obviously herself as well, played the Olympics in Athens, if I'm not mistaken, and has been involved in the coaching staff for South Africa, different national teams from South Africa, and is the current head coach for the University of Johannesburg. Nacho Bergner, Ignacio from Argentina, also former international player for Argentina, has been playing in Belgium for many years, so has been coaching different national youth teams in Belgium as well, has been involved with national teams from Argentina, and is currently the head coach for San Fernando Men and Lomas Athletic, if I'm pronouncing that right, for the women in Argentina, so where he has several of the Leonas players in his team as well. And down that way, we've got Lucas Judge. Lucas is a Australian-born but has integrated in the Netherlands for many years now already. So I'm guessing you're even a little bit more feeling Dutch now than Australian, Lucas.
Well, I mean, it's actually coming up to the point that I've been living in Holland longer than I was living in Australia, which is a bit of a scary thing to think about.
I can imagine. I've got the same feeling between Belgium and Holland here. So Lucas also been involved with the Dutch national women's team in the coaching staff and is the current head coach in the Dutch hoofdklasse for SCHE or Stichtse. I pronounce every non-Dutch speaking. I challenge you to pronounce that in the correct way. But SCHE played the playoff hoofdklasse last season, and we've got some top coaches out here. Guys, let me quickly just talk a little bit about the current status of the tournament. Let me just bring this up. If I push my buttons here, then we should be seeing this now. Yep. And we are in the stages where all pool games have been played, all crossovers have been played, all quarterfinals have been played, and tomorrow we will see the semifinals. So as you can see, the last quarterfinals we had the New Zealand Germany playing, and that was a 0-1 win for Germany. We had the Dutch playing Belgium, that was a narrow 2-1 win for the Dutch. We had some crossover games, some ranking games there, and we had Argentina England, which was also a very tight game with 1-0, and the last quarterfinal was Australia Spain 2-0, meaning that we will go to semifinals between the Netherlands and Australia, and Germany and Argentina, both being played in Terrassa in Spain. And that means that these nations already know their final ranking for this tournament, meaning that we have New Zealand on 5th spot, we have Belgium on 6th spot, we have Spain on 7th, England on 8th, India shared with China on 9th, etc. So these countries already know where they will finish the tournament. So a couple of questions for you guys, but also in the audience. We already have a couple of people who are asking the questions in the audience. Just let us know where you are from, and don't be shy. Ask your questions in the comment section below the video, and I will bring them on stage at the appropriate moment, and we'll have your questions answered by these coaches. But let me start with a question from me, and maybe start with you. Which team has surprised you at this World Cup, and why?
It's not really a surprise much as a team, but I feel that one personality that we've seen come through this World Cup is the Chilean coach, Sergio the passion on the side of the field, not even on the side, he's in the stands, but you can already feel what he's giving his team all the time. And the results that they have gotten or they did get is something you can feel from, you know, comes from the top, some interesting plays from them and great moments as well. And yeah, that's the team that stood out for me so far. We look at the top four teams already. Had you asked me this 3 weeks ago, 7 months ago, I would say, yeah, Germany, Netherlands, Australia, Arch, are they the top four? You would imagine so. So not too many, but from the teams that didn't make it, I think Sergio was someone that stood out for me as a coach that.
Yeah, absolutely. He brought a lot of passion to the stands in Amsterdam. That was clear. South American passion, Nacho. You will feel that, obviously. But which team that's or which coach surprised you during this tournament and why?
Well, I think I will continue with Polo said. I know Vigil very well because he coached me as well. He coached the first Leonas. So he was the coach who made the step up for the women's hockey in Argentina. So he's a really good former players. And I'm agree, Polo, with you, what you said. You can see, because you can see performance in teams, how they build the game in their defense. We saw a lot this in most of the girls, how they build up their game starting with the defense. And Chile, it is a team that they, of course, they build up the style of playing by different, but the position they get when they play, the position, the proposition on ball, how they are in positions to play, you know, the midfielders, the forwards. So you can see some interesting things. You saw some interesting things that if you implement that in with a top team, then you can see an interesting performance. So I agree with you, Polo, in terms of that. And then I didn't see big surprises in the top teams. And I see a gap of level between, you know, the top teams and the rest of them. So it's an interesting discussion that we can enter in the next questions.
Absolutely. That will come back for sure, obviously. But Lucas, also same question for you, obviously. Which team has surprised you and why?
I think a couple of things to add. I think if I look back at the tournament 4 years ago, Argentina and Germany weren't in the semifinals. So I think the expectations before the tournament are obviously that the teams that are in the semifinals will probably make it easily. But it's also, you know, maybe a good thing that the top teams have actually come and put their best foot forward. I think 4 years ago, I think a lot of the top teams actually didn't turn up at the right moment, which created opportunities for others. I think the team that probably surprises me the most, I think, is probably Australia. The reason why is simply Corona-related. If I think about the team, and the change that they've gone through over the last sort of like couple of years, also with a change of coach with Trini Powell taking over, not being able to travel overseas to play competitive international hockey, not taking part in the Pro League, and also looking at the amount of inexperienced players that they actually have in the group at the moment, the number of girls in that group who've never played a World Cup before, never played a major tournament before, is actually quite, you know, is impressive given the performances that they're putting forward at the moment. And I think, you know, it'll be an interesting game when they come up against Holland.
We're going to hear Ernst.
Sorry, muted. Typical disease of these online things. So yeah, I fully agree there. But a follow-up question in the same trend, but now look at the individuals. So which player stood out for you during this World Cup and why? Nacho.
We can talk about couple, but if I'm going to my Argentinian side, I will say Majo Granato. A couple of Argentinian players, they are in the top of their level, so it's a moment, interesting moment for them. So Majo Granato, I think she's one of the best. I think Shisha Oliva in Spain really impressed me as well. But I think, regarding, I think we are in a moment of different experience of games. So we have a mixed of experienced players, and then teams who are really renew. So related to that, there are a big difference, and I think experienced teams like Argentina or even Holland, they are in on top of that. So I think that's an interesting thing of performance in this playoff moment. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Lucas, same question for you. Which player stood out for you and why?
I think a couple of girls have sort of like, gained sort of a bit of attention. If I look at the Belgian team, for example, I think their captain, Kerniers, is a great player. I think she's had a great tournament. Very stable, sort of high level, like on the midfield. You know, if I see her playing against the Dutch, where she's often circled by three or four players, I think she's handled herself really well. And obviously with the goal that she scored, I think she's, put her best foot forward in this tournament, which was nice to see. I think Charlotte Engelbert, also from Belgium, is also sort of world class, and in the future will probably be one of the best players in the world. And I have to agree with Nancy. Obviously, I think Granato from Argentina. I mean, the thing that in this tournament is that you've got players who've probably got skill, but I mean, she's able to really sort of eliminate people and create things and also score goals. And I think that's something that you don't see too often. So I think, a couple of those girls as well. I think Spain's obviously got also a couple of players who are also nice to watch. Laura Barrios has been playing quite well. Obviously, Gigi Oliver, unfortunate that she's going to be retiring after this tournament. There's lots of players, that have, had a good tournament so far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Polo, same question for you. Which players
stood out? For me, it's always great to see someone that has given so much to the game, Eva coming back from a really big injury and still adding value to what the Dutch team is doing. But you know me, and I'm here about goals. I love the goal scorers. Watching Agustina do what she does has been something special, right? And you don't need to be super smart. You just need to be, the attitude we talk about in goal scoring. And that's what we've seen in this Argentine side. And that's why I think for me, we look at it like Germany, Argentina. Yes, we know the Germans will defend well. But how do you stop the Argentinians from scoring goals? You can't. It'd be an interesting stat to see when last they didn't score so many at any major tournament. And that is a challenge in the semi-final. And that's for me what's stood out more than anything is the goals, field goals that have been scored. We look at the stats right now as things stand. It's only 54 field goals, 79 have been from penalty corners, but how many of those have come from Argentina? And that is the challenge in the semis for Germany.
Paolo, it's absolutely interesting you say that, right? Because I think the game obviously against England the other day, obviously England defended very well. And I think that Germany are probably in that sense a bit similar defensively, so I think Argentina are going to have their hands full. I think with a short corner that's probably not going as well as it should be, and becoming quite reliant on field goals, they're going to have to score. It was interesting to watch them play England and sort of they were stifled. So if Germany and Valentino is obviously a great coach. Having watched probably England, do their thing, it'll be interesting to see how they come out and sort of defend against Argentina.
Big challenge, Lucas. You know that
big challenge. And I mean, I love goals as well. And in all honesty, I'd love to see like way more goals in this tournament.
Yeah. Lucas, how many hours of video do you do at a tournament?
What's that?
How many hours of video do you watch and
a lot.
Tournament.
Exactly.
So again, the more the tournament goes on, I just love to see the little twitches and little changes that coaches are making, depending on who they're playing and how they need to play to be successful. So again, these next two games could be massive.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We have a question from the audience, if I allow, because that's also a question that was on my list here. But we have Hans Soepnel from the Netherlands. Did you notice any new trends? And what can club coaches learn or take away from this World Cup? Nacho, did you see any new trends technically?
I think when I was hearing Lucas, I was completely agree with him. I wanted to enter when he said about Argentina and how to, the challenge to Argentina. I was completely agree. I think what we can learn, I was expecting more goals for sure, and that's game changers can do that. Players who make the difference can do that, but I think the defensive systems and defensive skills, I think, is one of the things that in women's hockey it was a thing that it's still developing and increasing. And how to break that defensive skills and defensive system is a big challenge, I think, for coaches in women's hockey. And then you, for that, you need, of course, a good playing system and then different players so who make the difference in that system, you know, when you play with ball. And then you have a penalty corner, which is another area from the hockey. If I have to split, I will split the penalty corners as a different aspect in the play where the defensive skills really develop. And then it became difficult to score goals. And we saw that in every game and in all the teams. So you don't have a big drag flickers. And if you compare that with boys hockey, so that's a challenge and something that even put on the question. When I remember yours, when you talk about changing the penalty corner rules or something like that, it's something that I was watching the TV. I said, oh, you know, high quantity of penalty corners and how to break that defense. And then the positive thing is how the teams defend and build their strength in defensive structure, because if you see the top teams, they have on-ball possession more than the others, of course. But it took really, really a big challenge to make that difference, score goals. And that's what Lucas said, Argentina against England, because those teams are good teams as well. And you know that they will have chances in hockey. You know that they will have a corner, penalty corners, as Belgium did against the Netherlands, England against Argentina. Germany and New Zealand was the same. We saw games on top, teams on top of the game, but if you maintain that defensive structure as much as you can, then you will have chances. So that's the message that I have from this World Cup.
Yeah, and any new trends that you spotted, Polo?
You know, there's that's why before we started, I asked Lucas about how well he knows Tim White, and I know Tim is gonna have annoyed me by talking about this. When he started working with in the Belgian with the ladies, I played against him when he coached the under 18s in Argentina. We had that Youth Olympic Games, and the style of hockey that he brings is something that is really special, especially into the women's game. And I said to him, the first game he was assistant coach for the Belgian side, and I said, Tim, I see your work. Like, what are you talking about? The accelerating passes that we see now in the women's game, the different use of skill, the hit was not something that we've seen a lot of in the women's game, especially going from defense to attack. And that's what we've seen differently in how Belgium plays. They go from winning the ball to getting into the 23 really quickly because of the change of technical skill. And we don't see enough of the hit in the women's game, but this World Cup, I've been impressed. I've been impressed. And, you know, it's what do we teach young women when they start playing the game? Is the hit encouraged, or is the easy skill, the slap, the sweep, wherever you are in the world, different terminology. But what I've seen here is that the girls, the women, have been encouraged to go forward quickly and to dare to go forward. And that's why I've been happy to see how many balls are in the attacking circle. So that, for me, is let's go forward. Let's go forward quickly. And let's see what we can get out of the opportunities that we created.
Yep. Lucas, same question for you. Did you notice any new trends, new tactical plays?
Yeah, look, I think my biggest takeaway from the tournament so far has actually been the use of the high ball. And not necessarily the high ball in the traditional sense of the word in terms of the women's game, but more the short high ball. So if I look at Argentina play England, a lot of high balls over 10, 15 metres. So not looking to, you know, go 50 metres or to escape out of pressure. Huh? So a lot of the times in the past, you'll see teams throw high balls to try and get out of a full press. But now it's being more and more used as an actual attacking option to throw a high ball over 15, 20 metres, 10 metres, just over one line. And that's something that's really sort of got my attention. Also, if I see attacking high balls used in the attacking half of the field, so not only as a defensive outletting option, but as an attacking option. I know that the Dutch girls use it a lot. You see it every now and then in the Hoofdklasse as well. But you're starting to see it more and more. So I saw, for example, a great high ball from one of the Spanish girls from, I think, on the 25 on the left-hand side of the field and threw it over to the right-hand side of the circle where somebody received it and was able to shoot on goal. So I think the use of the high ball, which we've seen in the men's game for the last number of years, is actually coming more and more and more a part of the women's game, which I think is fantastic. Opens up a lot of room for creativity for reaching all parts of the field that, you know, that are not necessarily available when you're playing over the ground. So for me, I think in my current role at Stixa, that's something that I'll be taking out away from the tournament to go further with, I think, with our team.
I'd love to add to that.
Yeah, go.
We talk about accelerators, right? And when we press in zones, we press in lines that are really good. But when the ball goes over the press, it doesn't have to go over two or three lines. It just has to go one line over. We've seen it for years in the men's game. And Lucas, I'm glad that you are telling me that you're going to take this into the highest level in terms of club hockey. You know, that ball that moves, even in the 23, across the field, onto the tee point on the other side, just changes the game. And I'm hoping, Ernst, when you know how many people have been watching this, I would love to see what that little nugget will do to world hockey in a couple of years.
Yeah, so you know, I think just adding that whole element of 3D play, you know, more and more. And I think, you know, in terms of trends, I'm not too big of a fan of, you know, the trend of one tournament. But I think if I look at the last sort of 5-6 sort of years, I think that's, you know, one of the biggest trends that I see sort of coming. The women's game is making sort of big steps in that sort of area, which is great to see, I think.
Yeah, and the disguise also on the high ball. Yep. You know, many years ago, we I think all four of us know when we had to move the ball 1 yard before you could do the next movement. Now with, you know, the south pass, we've seen people just moving the ball very quickly, looking low, over, left to right, right to left. The creativity that is we see in this, we've seen in this World Cup, has been amazing. Mm-hmm.
Are there any special new skills and new techniques that we often see in our local competitions, our domestic competitions, coming up from youth players, from the younger players who bring new stuff to the game? Have you noticed anything in that regard at this World Cup? I'm missing a little bit, but that could be my perception. I'm not sure that I'm right, but I'm missing a little bit the those individual 3D skills in a lot of teams. Obviously, yeah, the Dutch are very skilled. Argentina, they practically invented the 3D individual skills.
I mean, Ernst, like to jump in there, mate, I think, I mean, I'd agree with you. I think that it comes back a little bit to sort of like the point that was raised earlier, you know, about sort of the attacking play and being sort of creative, you know, when you're in attack, being able to create when you're in attack. That, I mean, that's not just being able to sort of like play together as a team, but at a certain point in time, you need players to have the individual skill to take people on and create things. And not only create things, but then also sort of like, you know, finish sort of actions or with a decisive pass or a shot on goal. And I think that's one of the big things that I've also been missing in this tournament is that I think that's something that I think that we need to see a lot more of, and which can be a lot better. And I think the Dutch obviously have it. I mean, they've had it for a long time. A lot of girls who've got the ability to take people on and have, you know, very good control of the ball. And it'd be just great to see if that was to, you know, was seen sort of more across the board from more teams and more players. Because like I said, you know, the more goals, the better, if you ask me, from an attacking point of view. And I think up to this point in time, I mean, a lot of 1-0 results, and that hasn't come from the lack of chances. I mean, it'd be great to say that it's because of the level of, defending, but I actually think it's just because of the attacking side of things just probably isn't up to scratch, I think.
And I want to jump well with that, and it's connecting what Lucas said and Paulo, is that the level of defenders, it's easier, or not easier, but more simple to develop the defensive skills, and then the challenge with the game changers and the individual skills who break that defend skills are really the challenge. So that's how in youth ages, starting in youth ages, how to give that freedom of playing the one against one, the in the last meters to finish the action, to create and that good skill of shooting on goal and create that space and give that the confidence to the players to do that, and not only that, continue with the action and then make that the last pass, just score the goal and give that freedom and confidence and create that players into the D, you know, the killers of the D. So that's the challenge, because I think it happened in these last games and in the whole World Cup as well, that you have the team that have many circle entries, and then how to create that space with many people and create the moment and to shoot and to get a PC with a good skill. So that's interesting thing in women's hockey, no? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the one other thing, Lucas, you speaking about the 1v1 duels, I think we're also still going too wide to take on the player. So it's not a direct, I see the space just 2 centimeters past your left foot, 3 centimeters past your right foot. We're going 2 yards to get around. And that slows down everything that the movements you have. You know, I think we're not, right now in this World Cup, I haven't seen too many players taking players on in the direct line of where they're standing.
Well, I think that's a good point you're making, Paul. Like, I think it's a great point that you're making, because I think in the end, I mean, it's not all about people winning one-on-one attacking duels, right? I mean, that's not what it's all about, but it's about actually creating things. So if I've got a 2-against-2 and I'm not creating the 2-against-1 by tracking to the defender of my teammate, then I can pass it to her, but then she'll also be stuck in a one-on-one. So, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, going too wide around defenders and running lines that are making too much use of the space sometimes can actually stifle the attacking possibilities. And so I think you're right. The control to be able to run at a defender, all right, and to play the two-on-one so that the person I'm actually giving the ball to is actually gone, is something that I think that we're not seeing enough of. So, I mean, I think it's a great point that you're making. I mean, it's not only the one-on-one, but it's also about how do you use the space effectively. And sometimes we're actually using too much space. Huh?
And again, Lucas keeps talking, Nacho keeps talking about the defensive work that we've been seeing here. Again, I'll give you space. I want you to use that space because I don't care about that space. But yeah, if you go past me, it's going to be difficult for me to get back. But if you go 2, 3, 4 yards away from me, I can still turn back and still be a nuisance. And that is, again, are we talking about defensively, are we better? Or with the ball, attacking the in ball position, are we not effective enough? And that's why we look at the goals, field goals being scored, not as many as we should be scoring. Not at this level. Not right now, not at this world.
Well, yeah, maybe you're right. And I think in the flip side, obviously, is that the short corner percentage, the amount of goals that are being scored from short corners, is also very low. The scoring percentage, I'd be happy in this tournament to be giving away short corners actually at the moment, because the scoring percentage of even the top teams is very low, which is also the advantage, obviously, for the defensive teams. So it gives attacking teams a lot to think about, which is obviously the point that you've raised, is it now good defending or is it now sort of like how effective are we on the ball?
And let me add one question from the audience here, from Bert de Boer from Capcom. It seems that PC conversion, exactly what you're saying there, Lucas, is suboptimal during this World Championship. And he raises the question, is that because of the field or because of poor PC execution of the team? Or, he says, has the video analysis progressed so much that the defense is so strong now?
Well, to jump right on top of that, I wouldn't put the blame on the field. We've also read reports, obviously, that there's a big difference in the fields, both in Terrassa and Amsterdam. However, the corner percentage in both places is probably just as poor. So I think the field's probably not really a massive factor, given that. Look, analysis has obviously progressed to the point where defensive organisation by the short corner is very good, and also for a lot of teams, even teams who are obviously sort of maybe not in the top, of the rankings, that's also a bit of a closed sort of situation that they can practice to the point where they're very well organised. Huh? So you see that obviously progress as well, and I also think it's also poor execution on the side of the attacking short corners. You can see, for example, Belgium playing against Holland. Key moments and the short corner execution was poor, which is obviously disappointing to see. There's nothing better, I don't think, than a well-executed short corner at the right time. But even the Dutch are having trouble. So, I think it's across the board something that all teams are struggling with.
Yeah, exactly. Another question from the audience in that regard as well is from Robert Gregor from the UK. So from a goalkeeping point of view, he noticed that several of the goalkeepers were laying down at the penalty corners to take away the bottom net. Is this likely to change in the future, or does drag flicks lead to more shots going high?
I think if I coach in the women's game, we used to, 2004 in Athens, how many drag flickers do we have? So goalkeeping was you log, two steps out, lie on the ground, make yourself as big as possible. Right now, do we have drag flickers that are deadly? We don't have lethal drag flickers right now across the board, and we speak about moments that are crucial, and I think the penalty corner is a leveler in the game, so looking at teams that are probably going to be ending between 12 and 16, you still have chances in matches, and that's in the penalty corner. Has there been enough work done in that set piece? It doesn't look like it. I don't think teams are giving that much effort to that set piece, because I look at any team from 12 to 16, you'll have three at least in a game. How do you use them? And right now, Lucas said it's the conversion rate is really poor.
Yeah, one thing that struck me during this tournament, obviously the low PC conversion rate, and the thing is that I have the feeling is, are we training enough in the women's game? Are we training enough? on this aspect of the game. Because also when I still see the former question, when I still see goalies lying down at this age, the stage and age, there are women who can do the drag flick. A lot of corners now go to the variation with a tip in from penalty spot or from the posts, where as a lying goalkeeper, you're also beaten. So I do not understand why there's not been more progression in this part of the game. Or am I mistaken here?
I think it's a really interesting point, because the amount of time that you need as a coach to spend in penalty corners, offensive ways and defensive ways, is just a lot, because you need to. If we analyze a program of your team, how do you build your game and how do you wheel ball, and then the amount of time that you have to give to penalty corner, because at the end we know that the penalty corner just give you the goals. So that's really a challenge. It's challenging because you have a certain time to train teams, and then you have to put in the planification of penalty corners. And then if you go deep into penalty corners, then you talk about players, and then how much time do you spend to the injectors, trappers, and drag flickers, and as well the technique, skill of tipping, which is really complex. So you need to develop all those players separately and then together. So if you talk about top teams, then your first team you need to develop, but as well it's something that you have to develop in the young ages. So in your program of young ages, you need to include the specialist drag flicking time, and you develop good injectors, good trappers, and good tipping players. And so it's really challenging. If you have we know that in young ages you have two or three times a week and 1 hour and a half just on pitch, and then separate you need to work everything, and separately when you create that moment or space to train that, because you don't have enough field. So it's a really huge big question. And really, honestly, Ernst, I was thinking, I remember when you talk about always penalty corners and to change the rules, I never was agree on that, because it will change the game. But you know, during this World Cup, I was thinking, what if you know, penalty corners in women's hockey, it's like can be like 7-4, receiving the ball in 33, and then you play a 7-4. So it will be something similar in the style of playing, because it will not be like another thing or completely different than the game. But that's a thought that happened to me during this World Cup, and I throw it on the table. Eh?
If it were up to me, it would have been gone from the table already now, but it's not up to me. I'm a traditionalist. I love the game the way it is, but I do recognize that we need some innovation from time to time. Thoughts, Paulo, Lucas?
I'm not a fan of goalkeepers lying down. I think you're probably right. That's a bit of an indication, I think, of... I think at the very highest level, if the corners are working well and they're very unpredictable, and you've also got drag flickers of the highest level, then lying down is obviously not an option. That's one thing. The other thing as well is it depends a little bit on which team you're talking about, and also the quality of the defensive corner. It might be the best option that team has at that point in time. And I think the other thing as well is, you know, like, training short corners is obviously something you need to choose for, you know, like, I think coaches within their programs have, you know, always got less time than they'd like. And therein they have to be selective, you know, so how much time do you spend training what? So it could very well be that for some teams, the priorities are elsewhere. And I think every coach just, you know, makes those choices based on sort of like, how they think they're going to get the most effective result possible. That's also very interesting. You know, I think there'd be some differences between sort of like the time that different teams are actually able to spend on set pieces and corners and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'd still love to see better flicking from, you know, not just from one or two nations. I think there is, you know, because you talk about time, there is time in the year, in the season, to develop really good drag circles. And I think over the years, we've had medical staff that have been so good in knowing how to look after a body that has to do this really special skill.
I reckon I'd challenge you there, Polo, and say, look, drag flickers is one thing, but I would just love to see every team have an incredibly fast injection and a ball that is stopped dead at the top of the circle, and that every single time.
I had a big discussion with some other people around hockey when I saw a game from Chile. Obviously, a team that we all were enthusiastic about, first World Cup, they brought some enthusiasm to the game. But there was a game, I do not remember exactly against who, but where they had, at the end of the game, they had five penalty corners in a row, and none of the corners were well injected, and none of the corners were well stopped.
And the funny thing is, like, I think then, if that's the case, then you might go to corners that are a bit out of the box, you know, like, you know, don't push to the top of the circle, for example, push it somewhere else. Things like that, you know, and in that sense, I'm sorry, Nancho, but I'm a traditionalist as well. I think, you know, I love the corner. I would disagree with John White, I think, in the sense that I don't think the corner at the highest level is as dangerous as everybody's making it out to be. So I think an alternative for the corner at maybe lower levels is a great idea. But I think at the high levels, I think we've got to, you know, stick to what the game is all about. But yeah, I think different elements of the corner need to be better. And that's something that even at a club level, we have trouble with. So I think, you know, like the injection and the stopping of the corners is actually sort of where my priority lies and not necessarily at the top of the circle.
We're seeing a lot of corners being injected now with the extra steps from the injector. Does that bring, obviously, probably speed, but do we lack the consistency of the right aim and the flatness of the ball because of that? Or
yeah, it's also, I think in that sense, it's also you know, weighing up your sort of options, right? I mean, do you go for speed or do you go for accuracy? And some teams would choose for speed over accuracy and think that a meter to the left or to the right is good enough as long as it's there quick enough. So, yeah, I mean, in that sense, you've just got to weigh up sort of what you think is more important.
Mm-hmm. Ernst, I'm looking at the comments here, and Rob McGregor said something very interesting. I think it would be great. Please put up, yeah.
There it is.
We look at the coach and the quality of coach that China had. Alison, in her years with the Dutch team, she had a lot of success, right, with the penalty corner. So, again, now we look at, do we look at the field? And we said no. As coaches, we say adapt or die, and we always adapt. So with the players finding it difficult, and I don't know, but you would think the brain trust that China has right now, there would be more success in more moments. And again, are we as coaches that important? And Nacho, I'd want you to answer that one. Does the coach make a huge difference, especially in set pieces?
I think, yes, I think you have to, the administration of your quality. So to see the quality of plays that you have, the technique that they inject, how can take your better of that player. So a normal injection or maybe a slap injection is because one of the players feel more comfortable with that. So you need to implement that, and the way that you develop your trapper, and then you have a flicker, because if you have a good trap flicker, then you can go priorize the direct penalty corners. And then if you don't have that skill, then you can have to develop the hitting, like Spain did it, for example, one of the biggest example in this World Cup. So I think we as a coaches, we need to share and take that administration of the qualities that we have and take the best of it. So that's, I think, if you go to coach the Netherlands, maybe will be different than Spain, because you have different flickers or different qualities. So that's how to adapt, I think, is that the challenging for the coaches.
Yeah, and honestly, I do not think that we can expect from even a quality coach like Alison Allen to overnight change the routines from a team like China. She's only been there for a couple of weeks, obviously, so or a couple of months, but even that seems not enough time to change something as fundamental as those skills from a penalty corner there. Let me move on to looking ahead at the semifinals from tomorrow. Lucas, what will it take for Australia to beat the Dutch?
Look, I think, in all honesty, Hollanders, I think, are still a level above everybody else, especially if they play to their own level. And we've only seen really that level that they can reach in the first quarter against Belgium when they played very well. And for the majority of the tournament so far, they've been a bit searching. Huh? I mean, they've been a bit inconsistent. And so what I think what it will simply take, it's going to take, roughly the same as what Belgium sort of put on the table, except there can be no mistakes. In the end, Belgium, lost the game. Also, the goal from Frekemoes, should never have gone in. So I think, personal sort of mistakes that are made at crucial moments in the game. If Australia can sort of prevent those from happening and play to their level as best as they can for as long as possible, then they're in with a chance. I mean, don't forget 4 years ago, when I was a part of the Dutch staff, we won the semi-final against Australia in shootouts. Australia is always a tough opponent. It's very hard going into both games to have any idea as to what the conditions are going to do to the teams that are coming from Amsterdam and having to play in Terrassa for the first time. Australia are obviously used to it. Holland aren't. They're turning up a couple of days before the game. So in a nutshell, that's what it's going to take. They're going to have to play really well, make no mistakes, and keep that going for the full 60 minutes. And if they do that, then I think the Dutch at this point in time are beatable, simply because they're just a bit inconsistent. I think if the Dutch girls can reach their level for the majority of the game, then I don't think that they'll be in too much trouble in this game or in the final, if I'm to be honest.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting comments that I heard from a coach who I spoke to about this as well, either, and one of the coaches who had the experience of that field in Terrassa. Because we've said the field cannot be a deciding factor, but apparently there is a big difference between the both of the fields, and the field in Terrassa is very it doesn't suit the free flowing game of teams like Holland and probably even Argentina as well. And one of the interesting comments that I heard is if Australia, who have the advantage of knowing that field, can put up the wall like they did in the previous games and really focus on defense, and then combined with that difficulty of a new field for the Dutch girls, they stand a chance of beating the Dutch women.
Well, I think the best thing about the World Cup, obviously, is that I think when you get to this point, I think everybody's in with a chance. I mean, games that are all or nothing, I mean, anybody can win. I mean, I don't think anybody should be under the assumption that it's easy at this point in the tournament. So, like I said, I mean, Australia are in with a chance. And in all honesty, I think that, they've surprised me so far, the level that they've reached, how fit they are, the way that they're playing. So I'm really looking forward to the game. I think it should be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Travel during a tournament is something that we as the hockey fraternity aren't really used to, playing some of your matches here and then having to move to somewhere else. It's not what we're used to. So again, mentally, how
crazy are crazy crazy it's crazy not, crazy
I'm just playing half a tournament, now I need to get on a flight. Why?
Crazy. If you think, for example, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but obviously here in Amsterdam, here in Holland, there's a lot of trouble at the moment at Schiphol Airport. So for, you know, the English team to have to, you know, go and spend sort of half a day, you know, going through all the, jumping through all the hoops, even to get into the, airport, let alone obviously get to Spain. I mean, it's a full day's travel. I mean, in all, in terms of a quality of, you know, sort of like preparation and giving both teams sort of like an equal chance to prepare as best as possible for big games. I mean, the tournament format is in that sense kind of ridiculous. And I really don't understand, obviously, why, they've sort of like gone for this option. I mean, let alone the fact that teams have got to go and play in a different stadium on a different field. In completely different conditions. I mean, it could very well be 40 degrees down there on the weekend. And so that's a huge challenge that also shouldn't be underestimated.
That's massive. And then, every tournament is different in itself. Now, adding travel during tournament, for me, like you said, the word is it's crazy.
I think, and as well, there is one, it's not the same for every team. So it's one team that stay and to stay in the same in Spain, and then another who is coming, which is not the same for everyone. If everyone have to move, even it's not the ideal, but they are on the same, you know, disadvantage. But now it's crazy because the food, the weather, the feel, you make your hotel your own home during 4 or 3 weeks. And then you have to change to pack everything, the staff, physio, and think about the players, the stress to move and to change, even the food. It's just crazy. And then if I don't, well, we enter in another discussion because I will love to see full crowds. So if you split a World Cup in two sides, in two different countries, you will not have a packed field. So that's a pity as well. So yeah, we step out on this and we can still talking about hours, and it's, yeah, and as well the fact that some teams have to wait 5 days. You play two games in 2 days and then you wait 4 days to play the game. So it's just crazy. It's a challenge for the coaches to create a good program to be and to have to be ready for the next game in the top. So
absolutely. So the question here from Robert Gagger from the UK is, would the co-host model would have been better if it was, for example, Netherlands-Belgium or Netherlands-Germany, closer proximity, obviously less of a travel issue? What do you think?
Yeah, but again, for me, I mean, I can see a comment coming through about sort of like the travel's not a big problem. And all. Look, for me, it's not necessarily about the fact that there's two different nations hosting the World Cup. That for me is not an issue. It's about having teams compete fully in one set of circumstances, and then coming up against a team who has to play in that context for the first time in a semi-final. And that for me is you know, raises the question about whether that's really fair or not. So I think, you know, having competitions spread across. Whether it's traveling across different venues in Spain, or whether it's playing in Holland and Belgium, or Holland and Germany, or throughout Germany, that's not the issue. It's about having completely different contexts where teams are just not able to prepare for. And you know, like comparing it to, you know, fully professional sports is also, I don't think, sort of like the way to go, because I mean that's, you know, obviously comparing apples with pears.
Absolutely.
So yeah. You know, I hope in that sense that everybody's, you know, like fit and well prepared, and everybody can put their best foot forward. And to be honest, you know, while we're on the subject, I didn't like it 4 years ago, and having a semi-final on Saturday and a final on Sunday is also not, I think, productive for the highest level of hockey that we want to be putting out there. So, you know, it'd be great to see if it was on a Friday night and a Sunday, a finals weekend, things like that. But, I mean, getting into that sort of stuff is more a discussion about, you know, what's happening off the field in international hockey than what's happening on it. So that's for another time.
That's politics.
We hit the nail on the head there. I think even when in Bhubaneswar, when we saw the men's final, how much energy did we see compared to games before? You can't have just just over 24 hours or just under 24 hours to rest and give us the same effort, same energy as you did in your semifinals. And again, we're going to see it again this weekend. We've had games, 2 days rest, 1 day rest, no rest between the two most important matches of the tournament. And these are the games that we want to sell to the world. These are the games that we want to sell to get those silly people that watch football or soccer to come over to the right sport. But we can't do that because when they watch a World Cup final, it is not what we can give. And so I know you're going to be talking about time. I want to say this. There are three female coaches out of 16 teams. So that's a conversation I would like us to have in a couple of weeks. Is it important? Does it matter?
Hey, Paulo, I mean, on that, like, just I'd love to talk about that. Be great to involve in the discussion, I think, on that subject, because I think the more sort of female coaches that we have around the place, both at club and international level, the better. And so how we can talk about, you know, making that happen would be a great discussion. But for me, I mean, I've got a couple of minutes and I've got to shoot off. But for me, look, I think Argentina are probably in the driver's seat, I think, to beat Germany. Very much looking forward to a complete contrast in sort of like hockey cultures and the attacking flair of Argentina against the defensive sort of state of mind of Germany. So looking forward to that. I do think that Argentina will get through. And obviously very sort of curious to see how the Dutch girls go when they go down to Spain. I do think that they will get through. It just depends on how tight it will be. And if I look at the last 6 months, then I think, look, a final between Argentina and Holland would probably be the two best teams at the moment.
Yeah, fully agree there. Let me ask one final question to all three of you. And Follow, I want to start with you. Is what do we need? What will it take for the other nations, the other countries, to step up a level and join the level of Argentina and the Netherlands? And because we've had several other countries who were challengers to those both top nations in last decades. Nobody ever at a sustained high level of those two nations. What do we need for South Africa, for England, for New Zealand to get to that level and be a challenger to the top two or top three every time?
I hate to use the generic answer of financial support. You look at where the top coaches in the world are, they are where they can feel looked after. So the players will always be better from an under seven level. Under seven, under 15, under 18, you cannot compete with the top four nations right now because of the support that everyone has in the country. And I think teams outside of the top eight, it's really simple. And I really hate to say this over and over. Money allows people to grow. And right now, countries outside the top five, top six, there's not enough support. So the development of their hockey, their structures is not quite there.
Nacho, any ideas?
It's a really interesting question. I will take like an hour to answer because I can give you the example of Argentina. So because we are in the bottom of the world, maybe it can be similar than like Australia, because I will try to split in three things. First, if quantity of players, so how to develop and make your sport like a big sport in women's or men's hockey, make it popular. So quantity of players is the first one. Then quality of training in the club level. So that create internal competition. And when I say internal competition, it's competition between inside your club and then with the rest of clubs around you. And then external competition, that's the third point. And with external competition, I mean international competition. You need support on that, I agree. But then you have crazy examples because in Argentina, you have under 21 teams that they never compete against international teams. and then they become top of the world or world champion, like in the boys under 21. And I was in 2005 world champion with my junior, and it was completely crazy because we didn't have international competition. So the internal competition was so strong that gave us the possibility to compete at the same level. And when I was at Belgium working in the federation, then we have those combination of quantity of players, internal competition and external competition, because since youth ages, you have a competition with the teams of the countries around you. So it's a really interesting question. And I will mix that with culture. Because one of the interesting points that we have here in Argentina, and I'm a big fan of Australia because you have disadvantages like us on that. And then the culture, the internal culture, take out the best of you to try to make that compensation against the teams that have international competition since youth ages. So it's a big mix of everything. So it's a really interesting question.
Last comment, Est, and then I've really got to go. But for me, the answer is actually quite simple. For me, it's about having a very well-structured governance model of the sport from the international level to the domestic level, so that every country knows, when they need to be peaking. Giving people the time so that things are predictable. At the moment, I think a lot of the time things are very predictable, unpredictable, and people are trying to peak all through the year, multiple moments, different levels, different formats of the game. And I think the biggest thing to try and get everybody sort of like going in the right direction is to come to some sort of coherent calendar so that people actually know sort of like the direction that we're going in. That will give people the opportunity to invest in coaches, to look for sponsors, because actually people know what they're signing up to. And in that sense, you can then look to the long term and invest in different levels of the sport for the long term and not only for the short term gain. So for me, it's quite a simple sort of umbrella sort of answer. And obviously, in that sort of answer, there is a whole sort of string of podcasts that we can do. But I think the most important thing is at the moment, so it's very unpredictable. People just don't know, what they're working towards, when they need to peak, and that sort of thing. And I think that if you sort out some sort of organizational model that folds all the different sort of like continents into some sort of calendar that works, then I think we'll be moving in the right direction. And I really have to go.
Okay, Lucas, thanks very much for your time. I am going to close it up. We're past the hour mark here. So, guys, thanks very much for your time here. Thanks for sharing the knowledge. Thank you for sharing your insights here. And let's hope for some interesting games tomorrow. Bye,
Absolutely.
Guys.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, guys. Bye.
Thank you. Yeah.